10 people being able to give $100 now, or 18 people being able to give $50, 800-222-9739. Our democracy, if it ever was, is being stripped away, and we are watching it happen. But one of the ways that we resist is to ensure, and one of the ways we resist fascism is to ensure that there are media outlets that can still speak truth about power, media outlets that are unafraid to say the hard things and cover the hard topics. So please, $900, you can continue to call even as we move into On the Margin, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. Support that which supports you. Support democracy now. You're tuned to WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Matthew Davis. Matthew Davis is the author of When Things Get Dark, A Mongolian Winter's Tale. In 2016, he founded the Alan Chews International Center at George Mason University. Matthew Davis has released a new book, A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm doing great, Ethelbert. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us during this fundraising drive. And we'll be encouraging our listeners to call in to the number 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Matthew, this book is fascinating. I really enjoyed A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. As I was saying earlier, before we went on the air, I read the book. And I felt you were juggling three things. You were keeping like a travel journal, a diary. You were also acting as a journalist where you were interviewing people. You were also a historian, you know, in terms of you're talking about the history there in South Dakota. And I was just wondering, all these things being juggled, the conversations that you had with your agent, Michael Signorelli, because you say that he turned the idea into a book. So I wonder, take us into some of those conversations that you had in terms of you have an idea, he has to sell it. How does that work?
Yeah, thanks for that question. The impetus for writing this was when Donald Trump spoke on July 3rd, 2020. And really when he spoke there was to celebrate Independence Day, but he also gave a very narrow sort of vision of American history and the memorials and the monuments built to commemorate that history. And I was not watching the speech live. I read about it later. And when I was reading about it, I began to wonder why he gave that speech there at Mount Rushmore. And so my initial interaction with the memorial was to sort of do a deep dive in its history. And then when I was conversing with Michael, we tried to sort of figure out how to tell the story of Mount Rushmore, both as history, but also bring it up to the present, sort of what the memorial, how its meaning has evolved today. And at that point, 2020, 2021, and now, you know, fast forward 5 years to 2025, when I was initially starting this project, I knew that I wanted there to be those three elements you described. I knew that there was going to be part of this that was going to be first person on the ground, sort of travel essay. I knew that I wanted to do some reporting from the Black Hills and talk to people who are directly related or interacting with on a daily basis the memorial. But I also knew there wanted to be history. And so how those three things came together was something, you know, a kind of a little bit of a leap of faith, because you at the time I sold the book, I didn't really have my contemporary characters. I wasn't quite sure exactly how I was going to feel about the memorial. I wasn't sure what, you know, my travels, how that would impact my thinking in terms of my relationship to Mount Rushmore. But what I really didn't know when I started this project, I thought that I was writing something that was more about the past, a sort of a history book. And what came, what I came to understand, especially as, you know, Donald Trump re-entered our national conversation, he became a candidate for president, he won the presidency again, is that a lot of the themes, the issues, the concerns that the book explores are not so much history, but they're present. They're sort of what we're talking about now as Americans. And that's something that I did not think was going to happen when I started this book. And so in that way, it resonates differently than it might have even just a few years ago.
Well, you know, you think about Mount Rushmore. If, like, for me, yeah, I'm going back to the 1959 Alfred Hitchcock movie, North by Northwest, with Cary Grant. You know, that's my not. Oh, that's the that's where that is. You know, and I just say that in terms of how things come into our lives. But I want to ask you a very personal question about these presidents. When you look at the monuments, or like me, when you were out there for the first time, what do those individual presidents mean to you, Matthew Davis?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And it's honestly hard to separate out what maybe I was thinking or feeling a few years ago versus how I think and feel now, having written this book. And I think for, you know, for me personally, even today, there is something I admire about each person on Mount Rushmore, right? I mean, you know, Washington, I think what we're seeing today, it's the importance of someone who was able to step back from power and not continue in power. You know, Jefferson, obviously, with his, he's very, very flawed, but his Declaration of Independence and what he wrote and these ideas that he had, this document, this political literary document, was extremely valuable. I mean, Lincoln is in many ways sort of this American saint, and a lot of his life is something that's, you know, hard not to admire. And I think maybe one thing we could talk about later on is how my conversations with people on the ground in the Black Hills altered my view of him a little bit. But then, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, for me, I always admired just his conservation, his establishment of the national parks system. I mean, the way that he was, he really valued the land in the West in particular in ways that I admire. Now, I think each president, both individually and collectively, you know, their legacies for me and for many people in the Hills are complicated by the relationships to Native Americans, the relationships to enslaved peoples, the relationships to how the land switched from Native indigenous land into American hands. But those are some of the things that I, you know, particularly esteem about the people on Mount Rushmore right now.
That's very interesting when you said that, because you have in your book, you quote Nick Tilson, who's out there, and he says that Mount Rushmore is an international symbol of white supremacy and injustice. You know, so you get a sense that people look at this monument and this memorial differently.
Absolutely. Very differently. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, that is, those were important perspectives for me to include in this book. I mean, I think, as you mentioned at the top of the show, one of the things that I do is kind of chart four individual characters and sort of what their relationship is to the memorial. And they're very different. Each one has, you know, varying degrees of experiences, both familial and personal, with this memorial. And I think it highlights, you know, that how Mount Rushmore in particular, but, you know, all monuments, all memorials, even though they're in stone, the emotions behind them, how we feel about them, are different for every person, and they change over time, right? They're not static. And so I think it was, you know, given the history of how Mount Rushmore came to be, it's not hard to put yourself in Nick Tilson's shoes and understand why he views the memorial the way he does.
Mm. You write in your book, and this gets just beyond the Mount Rushmore, you write in your book that the Black Hills aren't so much a location as they are an experience. What did you mean by that?
I had only been to the Black Hills once. And so I spent a ton of time in the Black Hills doing this book. And it has, they have become one of my favorite places to visit. And they're an experience because it's hard to do. You don't just go there, visit it, and leave, right? If you really experience the Black Hills, you need to hike through its mountains. You need to drive through its hills. You need to experience these narrow roads, these really beautiful ponderosa pine that are extending into the sky, to, you know, walk over this billion-year-old granite that was, you know, forged below the earth billions of years ago. And so to me, it's not so much a destination. It's a way to experience the world and, quite frankly, to experience the history that area has had over its thousands of years, which is incredibly rich, incredibly complicated, and incredibly fraught.
Hmm. You worked on this book from May 2022 to May 2024. You recently was back in the Black Hills of South Dakota. I was wondering, you know, you're returning like the prodigal son. Now that you've written the book, do you see things differently? You know, I know we were talking about you haven't had the book parties yet. I can see somebody doing the Q&A saying, well, you got it all wrong. I misquoted or something like that. Do you have a sense now going back that, you know, this is a second home? Or do you fact like you say, okay, I'm a little concerned about, I wrote this book. How are people going to read it?
Yeah, yes is the short answer. But it was a strange feeling to be back there, knowing the book is done, knowing people there have already read it, because even though the book hasn't been published yet, it's out in November, there are many people that have received advanced copies, whether they're, you know, in media or booksellers. And I was having this conversation with a bookseller at a local bookstore there, an independent bookstore. And I was, you know, I introduced myself and gave her some bookmarks for the book. And we were talking and she said, you know, oh yeah, it's very complicated. And I was like, wait, my book is complicated? she was like, no, the memorial is complicated. I was like, oh, okay, good. So like, I think there's definitely a feeling of, you know, when you're going there as a reporter, as a researcher, as a writer, you're sort of in process. You can sort of stay anonymous in some ways, you know, but once this book is finished, now that it's done, I did arrive there feeling differently. Like, okay, well, you know, now my work is done. And now it's sort of the work of the people to sort of decide how and whether and if they want to sort of embrace this book and enter into conversation with it, which I hope they will.
But you are also writing this book as a father, because you make reference to, you know, how are your children going to view this moment? And so what do you want your children to get from this book when they're at that age where they're saying, oh, let me read what my dad has written?
Well, they're thrilled with the dedication, because I dedicated it to my wife and to my two kids, and so they're very proud of that. But you know, I started this book for several reasons, but one of them was, and you know this about me, Ethelbert, but I, for many, many years, I have sort of gazed outwards internationally. I've lived overseas. I've written about international issues. I started an international literary center at George Mason University. And it's not that I was uninterested in American history. It's just that usually I was engaged in other with other countries and people from other countries. And so when 2020 happened and you had COVID-19 and you had the Black Lives Matter protests, you had these discussions about American history, I had a 2.5-year-old and a newborn. My second son Henry was born on June 3rd, 2020. It made me really just think a lot, as I think we were all thinking a lot about what it means to be American. Like, where are we as America and as Americans as we approach our 250th birthday? And so what I would love for my kids to get out of this book is to understand that, you know, American history is complicated, and it's okay that it's complicated, and it's okay that you can, you know, want to feel all kinds of different emotions as an American in relation to our country's past. And that's what I really, once they get to the age where they can read this, that's what I hope that they will get out of it and get out of other history books that they will hopefully read.
You write, Matthew Davis, in your prologue, this book has given me the opportunity to think about what it means to be American at the quarter point of the 21st century, poised at the cusp of our 250th anniversary. My question to you, Matt, is what role does monuments and memorials play in helping to define us as Americans?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ethelbert. And I think memorials and monuments play a very important role in not just how we think about history, but how we think about our present interpretations of histories. So memorials and monuments, when they're built, they tend to reflect the present moment of their creation rather than the past that they're trying to represent, right? And so I think, you know, as we enter into this crucial period where so much of our history is going to be talked about, discussed, written about, broadcast, the role of memorials is twofold. It's for us to think about the past, but it's also to think about our contemporary interpretation of that past. And so the kinds of memorials that we're building today, the kinds of memorials that we're sort of lionizing today that might have been built in the past, tell us a lot more about who we are today than necessarily what past we have as Americans.
Well, let me ask you the difficult question. And should we be taking down some of these memorials that we and monuments? We went through a period, you know, especially after George Floyd death, where we would question, well, why are we looking at these Confederate models? And then when we realize, okay, these monuments went up at a particular time in our history to sort of glorify, you know, the Civil War.
Yeah. Well, and the Confederate memorials are particularly interesting because I think they were. So many thousands, hundreds of them were raised and built and created for a specific purpose. And that was to create a narrative, a false historical narrative of the Confederacy of the American South. And so I think from that standpoint, I don't have problems with Confederate memorials being taken down, especially if what is going to replace them is a more complicated version of what they are replacing. I think in other memorials that offer into other kinds of conversations, sometimes maybe it's better to have memorials that are built alongside them, or interpretive programs that complicate the memorials, or other ways to bring into the conversations the kinds of more complicated conversations I think that we need to have around American memorials and American history.
Let's bring in a film. I was mentioning Reverend Bunn, but North by Northwest. But let's go back and look at a film like Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee. And you have the battle about who's going to be on that wall in the Italian restaurant. Okay, and you know the black people are eating there, but there's no black people on the wall. Okay, there's Frank Sinatra. You know, and so what happened? That becomes a thing. Like, okay, like people are eating there, like, but who owns the restaurant?
Right.
So, well, how do you resolve something like that? Because this is linked to somebody saying, okay, let's put, it's linked to what we see happening at the White House, and was linked to somebody thinking we should add Donald Trump's face to Mount Rushmore.
Yeah. I mean, my approach to all this and the thing that I have taken the most from just sitting with Mount Rushmore in particular and thinking about memorials and monuments is sort of what at the end of the book, the last part of the book, I sort of have different chapters related to questions, right? Where is a memorial? Who is it for? What stories does it tell? And what is a memorial? And I think, you know, you're talking about whether it's, you know, including pictures on a wall in an Italian restaurant or creating memorials or how you react to current memorials. I think those four questions are really, really important and really vital. And they will tell how you answer them will sort of lead you to understand why those are there and what we can take from them. So, for example, at Mount Rushmore, this question of where Mount Rushmore is in the Black Hills of South Dakota is the most pertinent question to that memorial. Why is this memorial to four presidents in the middle of South Dakota in the Black Hills? How did it get there? What is it representing? And would it be different if it were removed from the Black Hills and placed, you know, in the Palisades?
Hold that point. Because yeah. I want to bring Miyuki in, because Miyuki actually has all the answers to these questions.
Good. Help us, please, Miyuki. Help us.
Another reason to see E. Ethelbert Miller, you can have a good laugh in the morning. He has a wonderful sense of humor. But this is a very engaging conversation, which we'll get back to shortly. This is just a reminder that WPFW is in the last week of our fall fund drive. The number to call is 202-588-9739. We would love for someone to get us started. Our goal is $1,000 between now and 10 o'clock. That is attainable, but only if you go and make a call of support. This kind of conversation between E. Ethelbert Miller and Mr. Matt Davis is exactly what WPFW is built for. Artists and activists thinking deeply out loud about our world right here on the airways. And if you appreciate it, if you loved Ethelbert, if you appreciate Mr. Davis's work, please register it now. Let WPFW know by calling 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. We also are available online at WPFWFM.org. Or if you have our radio app, just go to Donate Now. Our wonderful radio app is available. And last but not least, we have Cash App. Cash App is $WPFWFM. Please indicate what show you're listening to on the margin, or just put in Ethelbert or E. Ethelbert Miller. You could even put in Mr. Davis, and we'll know what show you pledge to. and give as generously as you can. Please do what you can to support the show, to support WPFW. Ethelbert, in all his brilliance, is a volunteer. He gives of his time, his passion, his talent to share with you these great interviews. And if you appreciate it, please register it right now, 202-588-9739.
I thought I was going to get reparations, but okay.
No reparations. Okay. Thank you. And the people are going to call and let you know how much they appreciate and that kind of affirmation, but no reparations.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Miyuki. Matthew, I want to ask you this question, which is actually in your epilogue, and I want you to also read an excerpt from the epilogue. You write in the epilogue of your book, Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. You write, "At their best, memorials offer within themselves the possibility of reinvention." What do you mean by that? What do you mean by reinvention?
That memorials are not static. That just because something is what it is today and how it appears today doesn't mean how it's going to appear 5, 10, 15, 100 years from now. I think, you know, just because a lot of memorials are set in stone, concrete, granite, iron, that doesn't mean they don't have the potential for change. Because we obviously have the potential for change. Our interpretations of memorials should change. If they don't, I think that's a problem. And so that's what I meant by that.
Okay. What did you read? Just an excerpt from the epilogue, which you call entitled Ceremony.
Sure. This is from the beginning of it.
And you make reference to Leslie Marmon Silko's work.
Yes, exactly. Her book, Ceremonies, is amazing. His book, Ceremonies, is amazing. "I've had the opportunity to visit the Black Hills in every season, and there is never a time when they are not beautiful. There are some places I have lived and visited where the land feels different. It seems alive in ways that cities don't. It's not just nature, though. It's history. I'm aware of history in the Black Hills. I sometimes feel when I'm driving through with my windows down and radio silent, or when I'm hiking up Black Elk Peak or along Spearfish Canyon, that I can hear whispers from people across the years that people, histories, have never left but remain present in the pine like spirits." Want me to continue?
Yeah, yes.
"Part of this is why I don't think it odd to desire the four presidents on Mount Rushmore to move, to arise and dust off their half-finished lapels and groan through the billion-year-old granite and reach their full height. I imagine them waking up as a collective, yawning into a bright Black Hills dawn and realizing that though they accomplished so much and though the ideals they represent are powerful, perhaps they shouldn't be expressed here, on this mountain, in this land, and in this way. For as artistically adept and technically innovative as Mount Rushmore is, for as moving and powerful it can be for veterans and lovers of liberty and democracy, for as fun as it can be to bring the family to see the faces and enjoy an ice cream, I just don't think that Mount Rushmore belongs on the mountain of Rushmore."
You're listening to Matthew Davis reading from his new book, A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. Matthew, many times when we think about, you know, the Black Hills, you know, one name that pops up is George Armstrong Custer. Talk about how you weave that into your book. And then, let's talk first about the Lakota and the Sioux tribes first and then bring in Custer.
Sure. Okay.
So talk about, because you spent a lot of time talking about Crazy Horse and Red Cloud and what the land means to Lakota and Sioux tribes prior to the discovery of gold and the railroads coming in.
Yeah. So the Lakota, the Lakota call the Black Hills the Pahasapa, the Hisapa, Black Ridge, or Black Hills. And it's a perfect description. But they also call the Black Hills the heart of everything that is. And that name, that title, gives you an idea of just how central and essential the Black Hills are to Lakota belief, to Lakota cosmology, to Lakota identity. And the Lakota believe that they emerged from Wind Cave, which is a cave not too far away from where Mount Rushmore resides today, and that the Lakota people emerged from that cave and spread out over the land. So that is Lakota belief. And, you know, from a Western perspective, from an archaeological perspective, most archaeologists believe that the Lakota actually came to the Black Hills probably in the 18th century or 17th century. And, you know, there had been dozens of Native American tribes that had occupied, used, lived in the Black Hills for thousands of years. And the Lakota came to the Black Hills probably, like I said, around the 1730s or so. But, you know, what the Black Hills are in terms of the shelter they provided, the food they provided, the medicine they provided, the clothes they provided, were essential to the Lakota. And there are many places in the Black Hills and around the Black Hills that are essential to Lakota spirituality. And so for Lakota people, you know, the Black Hills literally is the heart of everything that is. It's a sacred space for them and for their worldview. And having lost the Black Hills, which we can get to perhaps later on, and is something that's a trauma that has lasted for generations of Lakota people.
Well, talk about that loss.
Yeah, so this is it's a very complicated story from the standpoint of all the different historical factors that were at work here. But basically, in 1868, the United States and the Lakota signed a treaty called the Treaty of Fort Laramie, and that treaty was ostensibly the United States suing for peace because the Lakota were attacking different forts that the United States was putting up along their lands along the west, along with the western South Dakota and Montana. And the U.S., having just got out of the Civil War, sort of trying to recede its impact militarily, sued for peace. And so that treaty gave the Lakota Nation a lot of land. And from our purposes for the book, in the entire western part of South Dakota was Lakota territory. And no American could enter that territory. It was illegal for Americans to be there unless you were a representative of the U.S. government or controversially, potentially, and it's not really explicit, if you were part of the military as well. And so, as you were mentioning about George Washington Custer, what ends up happening is just, you know, 5 years after this treaty was signed, there was a financial panic in 1873 that many people consider, exactly, the initial Great Depression. And so you have, you know, a lot of the symptoms that we're familiar with the Great Depression in the 1920s, you know, unemployment skyrocketing, banks closing, economies tumbling. That was happening in 1873. And what the U.S., you know, Ulysses S. Grant, who was president, there needed to be some morale boost with the country, both economically and for its own political morale. And so George Armstrong Custer led the 7th Cavalry on an expedition through the Black Hills in 1874. Mm-hmm. And ostensibly, the expedition was to find a military fort to put in the Black Hills, which, you know, was technically, maybe there was some, you know, consideration whether it was or wasn't illegal given this 1868 treaty. But everyone knew that in addition to finding a military fort, what Custer hoped to find was gold, mm-hmm. to really, you know, give the U.S. a boost when after this 1873 financial panic. And Custer's expedition did find flakes of gold in a stream just outside of what is today Custer, South Dakota. And that discovery, you know, had the impact that people wanted. Even though it was illegal, thousands of miners rushed into the Black Hills to try to find gold. And Ulysses S. Grant, who had told the line pretty closely and advocated for no Americans in the hills, sort of gave up and said, what we need to do is to get all the Native Americans that live in this area on reservations, and those that refuse to go on, we will find and we will hunt down and we will force them onto the reservations. And that's what they did. And so you had the American military wandering around the American West in search of these, you know, recalcitrant, in their view, Native American tribes who refused to go to reservations. And there was a big battle that took place at the Battle of Little Bighorn. The Native Americans called the Battle of Greasy Grass in Montana in June 1876, when Custer led the 7th Cavalry against thousands of Native American warriors, predominantly Lakota and Northern Cheyenne, and he attacked them. And his cavalry was slaughtered, defeated. There were some survivors who were on the outskirts of the fighting, but the men that Custer led into battle, none of them survived, including Custer. Custer was killed. And so word of his defeat reached the East Coast around the time of our centennial celebrations in 1876 in Philadelphia, and Congress and many other American politicos were livid with the Lakota, were upset by this outcome, and sort of began to lionize Custer and wanted to take revenge. And so the way that they decided to take revenge was to invalidate the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie, take over the Black Hills, take over the land of the Lakota, and that land has never been in Lakota hands since. And it's also important to note, which we can get to later on, that the Supreme Court has actually ruled that that seizure of land was illegal. It was a direct violation of that treaty. So that loss of land and what came afterwards, which was, you know, an extraordinarily traumatic series of events over the course of decades, has resonated and lived with Lakota people for generations.
Okay, we're going to take a little break. Davis, you were listening to Matthew Davis. He's been talking about his new book, A Biography of a Mountain, The Making and Meaning of Mount Rushmore. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
This is your social justice calendar for the week of October 20th, 2025. On Thursday, October 23rd, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Videos and Books Cafe presents a Howard News children's book event with authors Wednesday Boateng and Rob Hall, located on 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. Saturday, October 25th, DMV Palestinian Youth Movement will host the public forum, Cuba is Not Alone, End the U.S. Blockade at 3 p.m. located on 327 Park Avenue, Baltimore, Maryland, 21201. For more info, visit DMVPYM or MD_Cuba on Instagram.com. Also on Saturday, October 25th, the D.C. Girls Coalition will host their third D.C. Youth Summit from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. located at UDC Old Congress Heights Campus, 3100 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast. For more information, contact jsantos@blackswanacademy.org. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. Donate to our Fall Pledge Drive by calling 800-222-9739 or by donating at wpfwfm.org. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back in the margin with my guest, Matthew Davis, and we're also in the middle of our pledge drive, and so we're encouraging our listeners to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739, and make a pledge to WPFW. Matt Davis, let's talk about the key person, Gutzon Borglum. Talk about him. And I think somewhere in your book you mentioned that, is he responsible for the Sheridan Monument here in D.C.?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we can go out and see his work here.
You can go see a Borglum right down the street.
Right. Talk about him and who he is. You have a description in your book. Maybe you could read that. But also talk about him first, beginning with Stone Mountain.
Yeah, so Borglum, I'll read the description a little bit later, potentially, but Borglum is, do you want me to read it now, or do you want me to?
No, go ahead. No, how do you feel comfortable with it?
Borglum is a, he's an incredibly fascinating, complicated character. He was, excuse me, his parents were Mormons. They were Mormon immigrants from Denmark, and he was born in Idaho, but grew up mostly in the middle American West. His father had two wives who were sisters, and Gunson's mom was the younger of the two sisters. And as his family moved from Idaho east, more towards the center of the country, and Mormonism was illegal, his mom was forced to leave the family when he was 5 years old. So he was motherless on the plains, at least biologically motherless on the plains. And he had very little formal schooling. He had some, but not a ton. And so you have this sort of who would come to be one of these very important American artists, sort of start from nothing in the middle of the country, literally, and then go to California, get a couple breaks in California, become encouraged to move to Europe for a year. Or for longer than a year. He was in Europe for about 10 years, off and on. Really studied Auguste Rodin as the sculptor, the French sculptor, decided he wanted to transition from painting into sculpture and move back to the United States in 1901 and decided he was going to become, you know, a great American artist making great American art. And at that time, what that entailed a lot was public monumenture and sculpture. And Gunson Borglum was asked in 1914 to travel to Atlanta, Georgia, to potentially build a portrait of Robert E. Lee onto Stone Mountain, which is just outside of Atlanta. And Gunson took this idea, and like he would do with Mount Rushmore later on, he just went wild with it and expanded the idea of what they wanted to do down there. And when I say they, this is where it gets really fascinating, because the Stone Mountain project was initially run and funded by the Ku Klux Klan, which had had its second iteration, its second birth, if you will, on top of Stone Mountain. And what Borglum wanted to do at Stone Mountain was to not just do a portrait of Robert E. Lee. He wanted to include Confederate generals, Confederate leaders like Jefferson Davis, for example, Stonewall Jackson. But he also wanted to have, you know, everyday Confederate soldiers on the mountain. He wanted to include the Ku Klux, members of the Ku Klux Klan on the mountain. He wanted to, you know, if you've ever been to Stone Mountain or seen images of it, it is a gigantic mountain. And he wanted to take that entire face and create a whole tableau devoted to the Confederacy. And I'll be honest, as someone born in Chicago who has spent very little time in the American South, visiting there is kind of shocking, because there are all these street names devoted to Confederate generals. There's, you know, different homages to the states of the Confederacy and their and how they contributed to the Confederacy. Below, I visited there, I think it was in fall, September, October, a couple years ago. And there were pumpkin festivals where there were, you know, kids could go on rides and drink apple cider, you know, right below this this huge memorial. And so Borglum, you know, there's nothing I have read that puts him as an official member of the Ku Klux Klan, but he was certainly friendly with the organization and friendly with its leaders, introduced its leaders to prominent American politicians like presidents and House of Representatives and senators and Supreme Court justices. But he, Borglum, learned a great deal at Stone Mountain. He learned how to carve and how to work with sculpture outside onto a granite mountain. He learned
Let me ask you, who else is doing stuff like this in other parts of the world? I mean, who's doing this? I mean, you know,
very few people. He's one of the only ones. I mean, certainly there are outdoor sculptures, right? Outdoor sculptors who are creating monuments and public monuments, but no one's carving into actual set structures of stone or granite.
I was thinking in Afghanistan that the Buddhas that the Taliban like to, you know, knock down,
right?
You know, you think of things like this. The way you think of the pyramids.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And that's how Borglum saw what he was doing, and especially with Mount Rushmore. When it gets to Mount Rushmore, he thought what he was doing was in line with those massive public arts projects, the pyramids, the Parthenon.
Where does the labor come from? I didn't find, where does the labor, you know, is it black people doing this? where does the labor come from?
Where, at Stone Mountain?
Stone Mountain and also for Mount Rushmore. Who's actually doing this?
Yeah, I mean, in Stone Mountain, you know, it's definitely local people. There are African Americans who are working on the mountain. There are, you know, non-African Americans working on the mountain. When you move up to Mount Rushmore, what you're getting are a lot of local South Dakotans. You're getting, you know, miners who can't find jobs. You're getting ranchers who...
Are there any Native Americans? I think of how they were talking about heights and like sometimes in New York, the bridges were like Native Americans were doing the bridges, the buildings, the skyscrapers.
There might have been, but I don't recall any stories of Native Americans who were working on Mount Rushmore. I mean, there was a big... Borglum wanted to hire people that were outside of South Dakota. He wanted to bring in people who he'd worked with before in other projects to sort of oversee and work on Rushmore, whereas the local population wanted there to be local workers working there. So people that needed jobs during the Great Depression, people that were that knew each other, that were familiar with each other. That was the desire of the local people that were partly in charge of the operation of Mount Rushmore.
Well, one of the persons in charge of WPFW is Miyuki, and I think Miyuki comes in. Do you want to say something, Miyuki?
I want to say this is a really wonderful, wonderful, insightful, and informative conversation. We want to thank Beverly from Washington, D.C. for getting us started. Thank you so much for your generous support, and we're looking forward to hearing from many more of you. We are a little bit behind on this drive, and any monthly sustaining gift you can give, $10, $15, $20, $100 a month, will make a world of difference to us and will help Ethelbert get to goal. Like Ethelbert, my engagement with Mount Rushmore is Eva St. Marie hanging with her, you know, her shoe falling off, waiting for Cary Grant to save her. And so I want to go to the Black Hills. I want to go now to the heart of everything that is. I just want to go to that space from how he described and how he talked about. And again, Ethelbert makes me want to buy more books and read more books. And he opens up a whole new world to us, the things that, you know, he gets the most brilliant guests and shares all this wonderful information. If you appreciate it as much as I do, please, this is your opportunity to let Ethelbert know that he's doing a great job. You can do that by calling 202-588-9739 or going to our website at wpfwfm.org. Or you can use Cash App. Cash App is $WPFW. Again, think about how through the course of a month you spend, you know, $15 on a breakfast croissant and a cup of coffee and a napkin. Take one of those sugary drinks and one of those bad croissants and invest it in WPFW to ensure that these kind of wonderful conversations can continue. 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739. Ethelbert is one of the most talented interviewers on the planet. He reads all these books and he shares them with us. If you appreciate the fact how he previews and how he exposes us to these different things, please, WPFW, need your help. Ethelbert is a volunteer. He's doing his part to ensure WPFW stays afloat. Please do your part. 202-588-9739.
Man, I wanted to can you talk about Gutzon Borglum, but I also want you to talk more about Charles Rushmore, who was this New York City lawyer who like 18, because like his name is on. Like, talk about him, because it's not Borglum's mountain, no. You know. talk about how he gets in there.
So Charles Rushmore is a New York City lawyer who, as a young man, is in the Black Hills. I think it's the 1880s. He's representing tin mine corporations. Now, so remember, this is just about a decade after they found gold. The U.S. has just taken over the Black Hills. There's all these different mining speculations and mineral speculations going on. So Rushmore is a lawyer representing these tin mine corporations, traipsing through the hills with a couple of guides, and he stumbles across this mountain, which the Native Americans have historically called Cougar Mountain. But he looks at the mountain and looks at his guides and asks, you know, what this one's called. And the guides say, well, it doesn't really have a name, but we can call it Rushmore. And Charles Rushmore says, great, let's call it Rushmore. And so that mountain becomes Rushmore. And you know, when the project of Mount Rushmore got started, the state historian of South Dakota, whose idea it was to start this project, reached out to Charles Rushmore and asked for a donation. And so Charles Rushmore actually gave $5,000 to the Mount Rushmore project. And so I like to say that is the cheapest naming rights purchased in American history.
You know, I was thinking about that. I was thinking that you can't afford a stadium, get a mountain, you know.
Right. $5,000. It's not too bad.
You know, but let's talk about the actual task in terms of the composition of mountain. You know, why is it so you can't add any figures because of the actual how the mountain is consisted of the granite?
Yeah. So what I have read is that geologically, it's impossible to put another face on Mount Rushmore. And, you know, part of that is because of the fragility of the mountain in terms of where it's narrow. And part of it is because of mistakes that were made in the construction of Mount Rushmore. I mean, I think, you know, we're so familiar with how, you know, you have, if you're facing it, you have Washington to the left, and then Jefferson, and then Roosevelt, and then Lincoln. Well, the initial design was to have Jefferson to Washington's left. But, you know, one summer when Gunson Borglum was in Europe to attend a dedication of another memorial he had created, the workers at Rushmore got a little liberal with the dynamite that they were using to blast off the surface of the mountain, and they blasted off too much rock, and it became untenable to have Jefferson's face to the left of Washington. So they had a pivot and put Jefferson to the right of Washington. And what's interesting about that is that, like, when you think about how massive public works projects are created today with environmental assessments and technology and laser scanning and understanding, you know, where and what you can take off and where you can't, none of that was present at Mount Rushmore. I mean, it was created in a period where there was not the kind of professionalization of engineers that there are today. There was, you know, not the kind of government oversight that would sort of, you know, have different environmental impact statements on, you know, what they were doing at Mount Rushmore. And so, and certainly, I mean, what's amazing is that, like, it was in many ways an act of faith by Gunson Borglum that what he envisioned was going to appear on that mountain, because there was no real way of knowing how the granite was going to be able to be formed and constructed as they blasted and carved and dynamited and buttressed and did all the things that they did to create those faces.
Talk about Gunson Borglum's son, because he actually finishes the work.
Yeah, Lincoln Borglum is a crucial character in this story because, yeah, so Gunson Borglum was, he was a huge admirer of Abraham Lincoln. So he named his son after Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln, where Gunson Borglum was fire. He was an emotional, passionate man. Lincoln Borglum was more icy. He was cool, calculated, and those two worked really, really well together at Mount Rushmore. And so Lincoln, you know, Gunson died in March 1941. And so the finishing of Mount Rushmore fell to Lincoln Borglum. And he orchestrated and led that effort to put the final touches on his dad's creation. And Lincoln then went on to be the first superintendent of Mount Rushmore and stayed in that role for a handful of years. And so, you know, I, from everything that I've learned about the construction of Rushmore, if you read oral histories of the workers that worked on there, they will say that Gunson Borglum was a real pain in the ass, but that Lincoln Borglum was the person who would rehire them when Gunson fired them. He was the person that would, you know, pay them when Gunson refused to pay them. He was the person that would, you know, help to alleviate some of the problems that arose from having a tempestuous personality like Gunson Borglum.
There's another president that appears in your book. I wonder if you could talk about his relationship and contribution. That's Calvin Coolidge.
Yeah, Coolidge is critical to this story. So my book is timed to mark the 100th anniversary of the dedication of Mount Rushmore, the first dedication, which happened in October 1925. But that's not when construction started. Construction started in 1927 because, you know, Calvin Coolidge, who was president of the United States at the time, he needed a place to summer because the White House was going to be under renovations. It was not like today where they're destroying the East Wing and building a ballroom, but the White House needed some plumbing upkeep and some other sorts of renovations. And so Calvin Coolidge needed a place to go for the summer. And he was an avid fisherman. And so the senator from South Dakota, one of the senators, Peter Norbeck, convinced Coolidge to spend the summer in the Black Hills. And at the time, Mount Rushmore was really struggling. They were not raising enough money. They were not getting any sort of help from either the state government or the federal government to make this memorial go. And so Gunson Borglum and Doan Robinson, who was a state historian, knew that they had this opportunity to convince Coolidge to support Mount Rushmore. And so they invited Coolidge to give another dedication in August 1927 to the memorial. And that's that day that Coolidge spoke and dedicated the memorial. It's important for two reasons. One, that's the day that the drill bits were first drilled into the memorial to sort of start the construction of Mount Rushmore. But even more importantly, Calvin Coolidge, who was probably one of the most fiscally conservative presidents we've ever had in the United States, that day he committed the U.S. federal government to help pay for the construction of Mount Rushmore. And it was in his one of his last acts as president of the United States in 1929, before he left office, they actually signed legislation into place to allocate hundreds of thousands of dollars to Mount Rushmore. And without Coolidge's support, without the federal government's support, there's no way that Mount Rushmore would have been able to be built.
You know, talking about that federal support, I'm going back to North by Northwest. You know, I was looking at how Alfred Hitchcock was dealing with people. Like, they didn't want anything, they didn't want any, like, violence or, you know, anybody being killed on the mountain. So they had a little model, you know, I think, out in California, but they'd be doing a replica. But it gets into the whole thing, which is a very serious issue now, because of cuts and stuff, the upkeep. So I was just wondering, in terms of you being out there, before and after, and just recently, what's happening in terms of, will the park service, you know, is with something being closed, that mean that no one's taking care of the Mount Rushmore? Is it open to vandals or something like that? I mean, just what's protecting the monument?
I think right now, in the government shutdown, I still think the security measures, are still in place. Cameras, sensors. I still think it's very hard for anyone who had ideas of vandalizing Mount Rushmore or sneaking behind in the hills. I don't think that is possible. I think that kind of security is still very much present at the memorial. I mean, what you know, when I was there a couple of weeks ago, what you did not see were the rangers of Mount Rushmore, who offer interpretation and
the tour guides.
And that's important, because, you know, there's no visitor center, right? You can't go in and get a context for the memorial. And so what you see absent those rangers and those guides, or you just see these four faces on the mountain, and you don't have the historical, cultural, political context of why they are there and what they represent to different people. And so, you know, even though I think the upkeep and the security has been maintained, certainly how the memorial's interpreted during this government shutdown has been lost.
Hmm. How close can you actually get to the heads?
You can't get super close. I mean, you can get, you know, there used to be tours that would take you up on top of the mountains. You could see the faces from up close and be on top of them, but that stopped, I think, after 9/11. So you can get to the base where you can look.
So you talk about their head. Faces. Somebody said they Lincoln had cornrows. Is that true?
<I'm>
just joking.
It might be true. But I think you can get right up to the bottom of the faces and look up and see up close the carvings, but you can't climb the rock. You can't, you know, even where they're positioned at the memorial. It's not like you can sort of, like, if I'm under these faces, you cannot, like, look through Lincoln's nose or anything like that. They're too far distant for that.
Illuminated? Are they best to see it at night? Is it illuminated at night in terms of?
In certain seasons, they are. Yeah. So now I think the season for illuminations ending in about 10 days or so. But interestingly, with the government shutdown, there has been no money for lighting. And so the state of South Dakota has chipped in money to light the memorial at night.
Let's end on this note in terms of, one, you know, all of this, what we're talking about, does affect the economy of South Dakota. And what would happen if we didn't have those monuments? I mean, what else is in this state that's going on?
Well, South Dakota is very lucky that it has some tremendous other national parks. I mean, the Badlands are right there. Wind Cave, Jewel Cave, those are all there. But Mount Rushmore is certainly the economic driver of the Black Hills. I mean, I think in the last, well, when I was writing the book, there were over 2 million visitors that came every year, that generated millions of dollars of revenue.
Okay. I'm glad you said millions of dollars, because we have to generate millions of dollars.
All right, let's generate millions.
I think we come to the end of our show. Miyuki, you get the last word. And Matthew, I want to thank you for being my guest. Miyuki, you want to make a last pitch?
Last pitch is, please, folks, you are doing great. We've gotten closer. Thank you so much to Jim from Silver Spring, as well as Alexander Rounds from Tacoma Park, who says Afrobug is his college of wisdom and joy. Thank you all very much for making the calls. Continue doing so. We only need now $600 and we'll make the goal. $600, one person could knock that out by making a pledge of $30 a month as a sustainer. 202-588-9739, 1-800-222-9739. Again, engaging conversation, illumination on a topic and that goes in such depth and connects culture, history, and our own views as individual citizens. Please, this is WPFW is a leap of faith. Ethelbert does a stunning job every Thursday. 202-588-9739. Please make your pledge of support.
Okay, man, I'm saying this. I'm going to push for a monument to be created on campus of George Mason. But I want to thank you for being my guest today. Today, my guest is Matthew Davis. He is the actual founder of the Alan Truce International Center at George Mason University. We've been talking about his new book, A Biography of a Mountain, The Making Meaning of Mount Rushmore. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Jazz Hop Sound Sessions returns to historic Anacostia on Saturday, October 25th from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. along Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue and Marion Barry Avenue Southeast. Anacostia will become the stage for live music, poetry, local art, and continuous rhythm for the entire day. Presented by the Anacostia Arts and Culture District, the Jazz Hop Sound Sessions celebrates the intersection of art and the beat of D.C. Details at artthegogo.org.
WPFW has offered inspiring music, poignant stories, and critical journalism for over 48 years. Whether reminiscing while hearing Nina Simone or learning about the harm done due to gross global inequity, WPFW has been the soundtrack for moments of revelation, joy, sadness, and resistance. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. We ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our fall pledge drive by donating at WPFWFM.org and additionally from October 12th through the 25th at 800-222-9739. There is only one WPFW and only one you, the listener, who is committed to keeping independent music and message available to the people. Your generosity sustains and challenges us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
In April 2020, WPFW caused me to march on Independence Avenue to let Gaza live. Labor, Black Alliance for Peace, journalists, indigenous and religious groups heard speeches and waved Free Palestine flag. Satellites could see an oversized Palestinian flag. After, NPR labeled the march as economic hate, betraying Palestinian truth. That's why I support PFW. If you need to protect truth and democracy, support PFW with your time, money, and your life if necessary.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
The Can I Kick It outdoor summer movie series presented by Shaolin Jazz is back and is coming to Southeast DC for the first time ever. Enjoy three nights of martial arts and action films scored live with hip-hop, soul, and more mixed by WPFW alum DJ Two Tone Jones. Then on Saturday, October 25th, the series concludes with the screening of I'm Gonna Get You Sucker at the Capitol Hill Boys Club Artist Gallery. Each event begins at 7 p.m. with a guest DJ set, followed by the movie at 8:30 p.m. Blankets and lawn chairs are welcome. For more details, visit shaolinjazz.com. shaolinjazz.com.
Good news, family. You can now take WPFW everywhere you go with our brand new WPFW radio app. Stream Jazz and Justice live, listen to archived shows, view the program schedule and playlists, donate, and more, all right from your phone. Download the WPFW radio app today from Apple App or Google Play Stores. WPFW in your pocket. Jazz and Justice wherever you are.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW.